I don't know how it is for you, but to me, sesshin feels a kind of magic. It never ceases to surprise me. I know in the back of my mind there's something about sesshin that I really appreciate, but as I'm getting ready to put everything aside for the week, it can seem kind of like a chore. And, you know, I know we're doing this for some reason. And then I kind of feel like, despite myself, it, sesshin, whatever that is, starts to work its magic. It's just a bunch of set up stuff. It's just a bunch of forms that we agree on. But it's like a formula. It's like a magical elixir discovered by the ancient ancestors and passed down to the present. Just the right blend of zazen and ceremonies and silence and together action. It has its difficulties, of course, too. That that situation of zazen, of sitting a lot, that becomes more uncomfortable for our body, and yet something happens. Seems like when we sit a lot, that just at least for me, it just doesn't happen in daily zazen. And there's a lot of time to get to know ourselves. I think even if we feel like it's we're not really getting anywhere in particular in sesshin, probably, or we're not having a very good time, probably everyone could agree that we get to know ourselves a little better. We get to know our mind, maybe our spacious, clear mind, maybe our karmically ensnarled mind, in a new way, more intimate with ourselves. And therefore, I think also more intimate with each other in the silence and stillness. And as we say in the sesshin guidelines in the beginning, sesshin is a time to discover anew, clarify and actualize our deepest intention, our ultimate concern. And I feel this is so, it offers this time, but it almost forces it on us. We can't help but see our intentions more clearly, even if they're really strange intentions that might surprise us. So it's kind of a, sesshin maybe also could be seen as kind of a repentance practice. We see our ancient twisted karma much more clearly too. That's part of the intimacy with ourselves. It's a package deal. We get the twisted karma view a little more clearly, And maybe sometimes we get the clear and free view a little more clearly too. And studying the transmission of light this week is hopefully an encouragement and maybe also very humbling to hear these stories of the ancient ancestors. It can help us, they can help us clarify and deepen our intentions. So there's stories and many ways to look at. We've talked about some to look at what's the function of this lineage of ancestors that we're bring up one by one like this. I think one function is also that by invoking them, their presence, and invoking that light that's passed through these generations, we mysteriously receive blessings from this lineage of ancestors. Their sincere practice has its effects. And by our invoking them, by our just looking into them and bringing them forward, by bringing up their stories, for example, it kind of taps into their practice and vows. Well, that's one way to look at the receiving these blessings of the lineage. Is that the effects of their practice ripple out in throughout space and time, and by invoking them, we're kind of tapping into some of those ripples in conscious and unconscious ways. As we just chanted, although our past ancient twisted karma has greatly accumulated, itself being the cause and condition of obstacles to this light. The light's always shining freely, but our ancient twisted karma is the obstruction, is the shade pulled down in front of the light. We say, may Buddhas and ancestors free us from these karmic effects, allowing us to practice the way without hindrance. So we invoke them, and this might sound strange to us. How are we asking these long deceased people that are appearing on the pages of a book, how can they free us from karmic effects? But that's our prayer in ancestor Dogen's vow that we just chanted. Through their compassion, may they help remove these obstructions to the light, so the light can penetrate freely. Someone yesterday was also asked, wondering, when we hear these ancient stories, we wonder, in modern America, will it be possible for ancestors like these ancient awakened ones to appear? We heard about the, Dungshan's story with his mother and so on, and all these ancestors, a lot of what's brought up in the stories is deep renunciation of being caught up in the appearances of the world of samsara. Seeing through the empty dream. And we might wonder, are times different now? Is this too... is modern life too enticing? Does the dream seem too real? Maybe more than it used to? Or maybe it's just the same old dream, but are we willing to really let go? And is enlightenment possible in these times? And I think she was even asking, like, in a situation like this where we have such complicated lives and we're doing the sesshin and people are very sincerely coming and sitting here, but there's also lots of coming and going, and it's hard to put everything aside to do something so seemingly maybe pointless from a kind of utilitarian point of view. From the point of view of the dream, sesshin is ridiculous. It doesn't earn any income, but maybe it does earn a little income for Zen Center. And some people say, oh good, we should do more sesshins because it's more income. You know, there's so many practical things to take care of in this life. To keep the dream going. Yes.
I just wanted to bring up some of the great lay ancestors in this tradition who they talk about great enlightenment. Layman Peng comes to mind. Obviously, Vimalakirti. So, you know, for me and for us here, how does just practicing with that dynamic of how we come here and how we go out there and kind of keeping that continuum, that thread is continuous. It's not, well, now we're practicing here. We need to practice with this great intensity of these ancestors that we're reading about. Otherwise, we're just kind of spinning our wheels here. So
how to bring that great intensity into life outside of sesshin, for example.
And where that interface is, where they're both, you know, together.
You know, so. Yeah, yeah.
And just finding inspiration from, you know, great lay ancestors.
Yeah.
Who mm-hmm. did achieve enlightenment. So.
Dogen, especially in his early writings, praises the possibility of practice in the world, lay kind of practice, in Dendowa especially, saying, and he brings up the stories of some emperors who were really, and politicians who were really committed to the way, and he says, but he doesn't talk so much about, like, I mean, maybe it's implied, but he doesn't talk so much about what they're doing as in the emperor role. He's just said, between their duties, they constantly sat zazen. He's like, that's, maybe he's emphasizing that that's, for him, that's the essential practice of dropping off. But of course, it can happen in any situation. And I think there's always been retreat times set aside for more, what I call intensive practice. And not arbitrarily, because they do seem to, those conditions, this is kind of from the point of view of the dream, that certain conditions seem to, dissolve the dream more easily than others. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been passed down for so long. And I think, we can see how we can bring the practice into all activities. We have to do that. Even sesshin includes a lot of zazen, but it includes a lot of activities too, that we try to keep that zazen in mind. And I think another point that came up in this discussion is yesterday, this person was asking, but what about the enlightenment that, you know, of these ancient ancestors? Is that possible these days? And afterwards I thought, well, we have all different ideas of what is this so-called enlightenment, and it's being celebrated in these stories, and does it have to look a particular way? You know, so these ancestor stories tend to look very similar. They emphasize the outward renunciation part a lot. But I think in different contexts, in different situations, the enlightenment doesn't have any fixed marks of how it appears. And yet, we don't want to fall into the side of, well, it's all the same. There's no such thing, even, maybe. Yes.
Maybe combining those two a little bit. After Rev published his latest book, I sat with him, and it was about the third turning, and I asked him if he thought about the fourth turning. And he says, once in a while, he goes, I have a feeling I'm going to. And I think the fourth turning is what we're actually in now. And every time there's a turning, it seems to me, the new arena uses the last arena as its gymnasium for training. So, you know, we have everyday life is suffering as a gymnasium for, you know, the Eightfold Path and the first turning. And then we have the wisdom literature, and then taking precepts and becomes a gymnasium for that. And we have a third turning, and so emptiness literature and a lot of what we do here becomes a gymnasium for that. So I think the summit of the third turning is now just a gymnasium. So this is an activity. It's a very focused activity in which very little changes, so that I can at least have a deep sense of what's always moving in me that I don't notice because it's always moving. So the fourth turning is really moving into the world, taking it into the world, and dropping it all, just embodying the practice in that way. So there's the enlightenment. I think the enlightenment is just a continuous disendarkenment. That's what I call it. And all the enlightenment of the ancestors was the light that was born to these people. It was like us. And they had their gym, and they had their arena. And through a wholehearted practice, they disendarkened. And the light that was kind of native to them, which they didn't earn, was allowed to show through, came through. And it goes to my point I was making yesterday, that maybe that's authenticity. That light is authenticity as opposed to authority, which, you know, kind of carries credentials with it. And I think the bearing of authority and learning of authority and all that is the gymnasium. And so I think that's what we have now. So this is not a summit experience, this is a gymnasium experience. This is the concert pianist playing etudes, the performance is Carnegie Hall, or for us, the street. But we practice here, and that we are, I think, becoming aware of ourselves and getting out of the way of our light, you know, pointing the blind up, as you say. So I think I've finally gotten comfortable with the idea of this is a gymnasium and no longer arguing as to whether this is the summit I want to sit on. It's just a gym. You know, I just want to be an everyday person out there. So thank you.
To study the Buddha way is to study the self. Who are we really in all of these different situations? Can we let the myriad things carry us and confirm us rather than carrying ourself forward, our illusory self forward, and kind of peeing on our corner of the world. Yes.
I want to bring up something that I brought up, I think about a year ago, that I think very much relates to what Diana was, his description of the gymnasium, but it's a teaching of Norman Fisher when he was talking about, you know, addressing the question, can we really say that we practice and live in the world? Can we say that? Is there such a thing? We look at the ancestors and they're chopping off arms and eyelids and, you know, and their mother's withering. But to me, that's a question it's a daily question that's so alive for me. And so his teaching that if we try to settle that question, we're completely, like, selling ourselves short. If we, you know, that's the dynamic tension that we live in every day. This is, you know, is it, what is practice asking us? And in the situation that we're in, what is practice asking us?
I think that's a really beautiful way to say it, is that can we live in this tension daily without resolving it? I think we'd like to say, and sometimes we need the encouragement and we need to say, yes, it's possible and I'm going to do it and I am doing it. Sometimes there's room for that, but that might be a little falling into one extreme. And then the other extreme is like, no, it's impossible. And the conditions in my life are such that I'll never be able to practice like those ancestors. So I just resolve myself to the fact of practicing halfway for the rest of this life and then die. That's another extreme, kind of depressing one, maybe. So without falling into either way, either way is kind of comfortable in a way for the self, because
we kind of yearn for that resolve.
Yeah, some resolve.
There's a complacency.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, in either way, and a kind of identity, which is why it's kind of comfortable. I'm just like this, and this is how I'm practicing, or I'm a little me like this, or I'm a big me like this, and I'm really doing it, I have no doubt. In between that, let's keep asking, and what's the practice in a moment-to-moment way. Yeah, it's hard to live in that dynamic tension. I personally feel the pressure of that tension. I think often about, you know, my life here in Santa Cruz, and I really, it's a big question for me whether this is going to be like a long-term thing or not for me to be here. And I would so much like to just be done with that questioning. I'm just like, okay, here's how it is. Now forget, now just do it. But it doesn't seem to work that easily. Yeah. And,
I was just going to say, I find it easier once I just decided that I'm just going to live in this tension, mm-hmm. rather than try to resolve it and to not be in conflict with the tension, and to be dragged around.
In a way, that's kind of...
What could be better than that?
Well, in a way, that's kind of a resolving, you could say, in one way, is the resolve to live with the tension of being unresolved.
Right. I don't know if it makes it any more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's kind of what we're looking for, is to just... And you were talking about earlier, before, you know, sitting zazen and engaging our tangled, twisted karma while we're sitting there, which isn't really the most comfortable thing to be engaged in.
But it's part of the process.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's a resolve in one way to say, well, I'm just going to do this, but it doesn't make it any less uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing when you're talking about unresolved questions, to say, well, I'm just going to do this, but it doesn't necessarily make it any more comfortable to live in that tension.
Yeah. And also, I think just resolving to, I'm going to live in this tension without knowing kind of which way my life is going to go. Also, that not to fall into that being like a kind of fixed, permanent position either. Like, maybe there'll be one morning I'll wake up and I'm like, I see, suddenly it's totally clear. Today, I walk out the door into the mountains. We hear stories like that sometimes too. Suddenly, somebody just like, their heart is moved in some particular way, and like, then, you know, then there's some maybe other unresolved issue there in the mountains. Yes.
We know from the Tenzin Kyokun that this has been a problem for a very long time. that is, the current practitioners comparing themselves to past practitioners. Dogen says, he was living in the 13th century, and he was writing about the ancients, comparing the ancients to people of today. He said, well, the ancients got three coins, and they made a broth of coarse greens with three coins, and now with the same three coins, we must make a high-quality cream soup. He goes on to say that this is very difficult, because the difference between the ancients and the people of today is as different as between heaven and earth.
Yeah.
But then he goes on and concludes that with sincere practice and sincere effort, we can match the ancients, or in our case, match any past practitioners, whether they're recent past or very, very far in the past. So it's comforting to me to know that even if I personally don't live up to the past practitioners, that it's at least people have been considering this for a very, very long time. So it's not that Dogen was sitting around being like, wow, this is, look at us practicing so hard, in the future they're going to wish they could practice like this. It's all downhill from here.
Yep. I think it is, it's almost like it's part of the Zen tradition to revere the ancients. There's some term even that Dogen uses, like revering the ancients. It's a Zen thing. And you could say, is that just a big delusion? But
it's a Japanese thing too.
Yeah, I think, yeah, an Asian thing in general. Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, that's in there too. But I think part of it is too a way to a deep humility, a deep being deeply humble. I think there's a tendency, maybe in American Zen, maybe more than Japanese Zen, I don't know. It's a just different flavor a little bit, but I think there's this, maybe because of this very tension that we're talking about, I think there's some tendency, you see it in kind of like, you know, ads in the Buddhist magazines and stuff like this, that like, this is the authentic way, truly the thing, you know, gone beyond all practices before. Those, all those thousands of years of the Asian Buddhists, they were really missing the point. We got the real thing now, free of all those cultural trappings. And I think we have, I hear this kind of thing, like this great confidence in our way, you know. And I think that's part of the tension too, because we need confidence. We do need confidence to practice wholeheartedly, and yet balanced with humility that's not like a self-deprecating. It's a fine line. I think that, like, just being humble and realizing I really want to practice wholeheartedly, and I repent all my shortcomings in doing that, and I continue. And it's a, the fine line is like, I'm just so lousy, I can never do this, and you know, maybe you remember this saying from the Denko Roku, Keizan, talking at the end of the Huainong section. He says, moreover, for 90 days this summer, during the practice period, I have spoken of this and that, commenting on the past and present, and explaining the lives of the Buddha ancestors with wild and gentle words. I have gone into the subtle and fine, which words cannot describe, and treated you all like children and grandchildren, my own family, and more, besmirching the Zen tradition and displaying our shame. Consequently, you may think that you have penetrated the truth and acquired power, but you do not seem to have accorded intimately with the intentions of the ancestors. Your behavior is not at all like that of our wise predecessors. Because of causes in past lives and good luck, we've been able to meet. If you single-mindedly make an effort in the way, you will achieve the way, but many of you have not reached the other shore yet. You have still not peeked into the profound heart of the matter. It's been a long time since the Buddha went away. You've not completed your work in the way, and life is slipping away, so why wait till tomorrow? Summer's over and fall begins. You'll be taking off in all directions, scattering here and there as always. How can you recklessly memorize a word or half a sentence and call that my dharma or my way, and hang on to a piece of knowledge or half an understanding and think this is the way of the Mahayana? Even if you've acquired power sufficiently, the shame of our family is still exposed. How much less should you teach the Dharma pretending to be something you're not and spouting nonsense? If you really want to reach this realm, do not vainly waste time day or night and recklessly misuse your minds and bodies. Kazan's admonitions to the assembly.
He's talking about being fully present. And I think the shame is this tendency to glorify and deify the ancestors, to gild the Buddha statue in gold and all. It's a kind of underachievement, I think. There's two kinds of underachievement. One is particularly a goal that's just so impossible to meet that you have an excuse for failing. The other is to pick a goal that's so impossible not to fail in that you could actually praise yourself.
That's a nice way to put it.
Two kinds of underachievement. But the humble way, and I think this is the shame of the ancestors, which is kind of an ironical statement, is that I think if they were doing what we were talking about yesterday, they were all becoming more humble. They were all putting down their, you know, the tyranny of their sentient ideas, and they're constantly doing it to themselves and slapping their students into that kind of present moment. But we get away from it, and we say, you know, oh, will I ever be able to practice like the ancestors? Is it all worth it? What we're doing is getting into past casting and future casting. We have no way of knowing what the ancestors' practice was like, apart from acting on what is resonating in us when we hear their words in this present moment. We cannot compare ourselves to anybody.
We don't really know their how exactly they really practiced. And of course, the stories that get enshrined in these volumes are the best ones. We don't hear about all the fights they had, which I'm sure they had, right? But they don't get recorded because it's not appropriate to record them. Sometimes, occasionally, a nice thing about Zen is it sometimes does record the problems. like the Tenzo who got kicked out and lived in a hut at the foot of the mountain. So, but I think your way of saying that we can make enlightenment so impossible that then we have the excuse to not practice it because it's too far reaching, or we can make it so easy that we have the excuse to not practice wholeheartedly because everything's already it. And that's true. So we don't make enlightenment into any fixed thing. And we practice just for the sake of practice. Back to our story. For those just arriving, we're on the transmission of light record. We're on the story of our ancestor Dung Shan, who is talking about the teaching of the insentient. And for those arriving, backtrack just a little bit here. We have this, non-sentient beings teaching the Dharma. So we have the case, the central story here is Dungshan asked Yunyan, who can hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma? And Yunyan answered, the non-sentient can hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma. And Dungshan said, do you hear it? And Yunyan said, if I could hear it, you would not be able to hear me teach the Dharma. And Dungshan said, in that case, I don't hear you teach the Dharma. And Yunyan said, well, if you still don't hear me teach the Dharma, how much less can you hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma? And Dungshan was greatly awakened at this point. So we've been talking about the non-sentient, and which is often brought up as rocks, tiles, walls, and pebbles constantly teaching Dharma. But sentient beings can't hear that Dharma. Only non-sentient beings can hear that Dharma. So this was a little surprise at the end, near the end of this chapter, where this is Keizan saying, as for the story about the non-sentient teaching the Dharma, this workman, notice that he's a lay practitioner. Chang Fen of Nanyang asked National Teacher Hui Chung, I humbly confess that when you speak of the non-sentient teaching the Dharma, I do not understand. I entreat you to instruct me. And the National Teacher said, if you ask about the non-sentient teaching the Dharma, you must understand non-sentience. Then you'll be able to understand. This is the key point. What is meant by non-sentient? And this workman said, please explain what non-sentient is right now so that a sentient being can understand it. See, he's a very sincere practitioner. I want to know, so please tell me now. And instead of just raising a whisk or something like they usually do, the National Teacher actually says, gives him a sentient being instruction. He says, right now, within everyone, or within all activities, when ideas about these two categories of ordinary and holy do not arise or cease in the slightest way, there is a subtle consciousness that's unrelated to existence and non-existence. Keenly aware, but without any attachments. And this is the non-sentient. It's a non-sentient being. Is this subtle consciousness or mystic consciousness? And again, modern Japanese dictionary says something like kind of dim, hazy. Yeah, this character Yu. So Yu Shiki is subtle consciousness. As I recall, there's hanging on the wall at Jikoji, there's this calligraphy by Koban, white on black, very beautiful, large, dynamic calligraphy. I think says Yu Ko, the same character for subtle, and light, subtle light. And then he, in his little explanation of the calligraphy, he says, this character is very hard to translate. It's a very subtle, mystical character that you can't quite even put a name on it in English. It's not the sixth consciousness that not the mind that relates to objects. It's not one of the sense consciousnesses. It's not the seventh consciousness of the illusion of a separate self. It's not the eighth consciousness, the storehouse that contains everything else that is infused with duality. It's a subtle wisdom mind. It's the nature of mind. So now this is where we left off yesterday. Keizan says, if you know that wherever you go alone, then there's never a moment when all things do not accord with this true reality or with suchness. And I think he's referring to Dungshan's verse when he saw his reflection in the stream, and he said, earnestly avoid seeking it from someone else or outside yourself, or you'll be far apart from your true self. Solitary now am I and independent, but I meet it everywhere. Or we could say, now I go on alone, but I meet it everywhere. I alone am the world honored one. There's nothing or anyone outside of this experience. Totally alone. everywhere I meet it. And you have a sense that everything is included in this I alone. There's nobody else out there. And in this realm where I go on alone, I meet him or meet it everywhere. All these beings we meet intimately, but it's really I alone. So that's Dungshan's insight when seeing his reflection in the stream. So now Keizan's saying, if you know that wherever you go alone, then there's never a moment when all things do not accord with true suchness. The ancients said, there is no knowing outside of suchness that is verified through suchness. No reality, no suchness outside of knowing that is practiced through knowing. So, it's just a little sentence, little point here, but I thought this is a really beautiful little saying. These two kind of reversals. So, again, he's, as we'll see, as this paragraph goes on, Keizan's making the point that this suchness, the reality or suchness of the way it all truly is, free of all our ideas of it, is a kind of knowing. That suchness is in the case of this subtle consciousness, is a kind of aware emptiness. Right? We also call Buddha nature. It is suchness that is alive. It's not just it's not just a rock being a rock. It's this. I mean, that is part of suchness. or maybe we should say a rock, going beyond being a rock is the suchness of the rock. But this suchness we're talking about here, this subtle consciousness, reality, is a knowing. It's a aware knowing. So this, some ancients said, there is no knowing outside of suchness. There's no, like, we could maybe even say that wisdom. There's no wisdom outside of suchness that is verified through suchness. And partly, I think this is a nice pair of sentences because it uses Dogen's favorite expression, shu shou, practice and verification. It kind of divided. It uses the shu in one sentence and the shou in another. So in this case, there's no knowing or wisdom outside of suchness that is verified, shou, through suchness. Suchness cannot verify something, some abstract wisdom outside itself. The wisdom is suchness. There's no knowing, true knowing, true wisdom outside suchness. So suchness cannot verify some knowing outside of itself. And the next sentence is, there is no suchness outside of knowing that is cultivated or practiced, the shu of shusho, through knowing. Yes.
As we're going through the acharyas this morning, there was one named Zenshin. And I don't know what character Zen is there. But I've been contemplating a lot on Zen Shin and translating it as wholehearted mind. And there have been times that I've been face-to-face with somebody in which there is absolute wordlessness and there was total presence and a kind of communication which is very fragile but very strong at the same time. And it's what I imagine is the relationship, well, between a teacher and a student of this kind. And if I take that then and say, am I approaching looking at the floor the same way? And letting the floor meet me the same way the teacher's eyes, am I doing that? At that point, there is no concept. And I wonder if that's what it means to encounter suchness, and that there's no suchness that can be described outside of suchness.
Or outside of knowing.
Outside of knowing.
And there's no knowing outside of suchness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But so often, I'm not sure I can walk about the world that way all the time. I have to back off and drive the car. But I think that just that immediate presence to is what's real. That's really what's real. But it is a practice. It's not, and apart from doing it, you can't say anything about it.
No, you can't say anything about it. True suchness is unmoving, clear and distinct, constant knowing. Therefore, it is said that it is perfectly clear knowing and is unconnected with thought. And you can't say anything about it. Keen awareness, or deep awareness, is not attachment. Guishan said, ultimately, I cannot tell you in words. He also said, if sentient beings could hear it, they would no longer be sentient beings. So remember, this is all revolving around the teaching of the non-sentient, and now we're hearing that this suchness that is a clear knowing is a non-sentient being. And that one can hear the teaching of non-sentient. And if a sentient being can hear the teaching of the non-sentient, then they're no longer a sentient being. They become an insentient being. In other words, they are just perfectly clear knowing, unconnected with thought. Because he received the instructions of several teachers and understood true non-sentience, Dongshan promoted the Soto tradition extensively as our ancient ancestor. Thus, good people, by inspecting fully, you become keenly aware of this subtle consciousness. It is called non-sentient. It is called non-sentient because there is no running off after sounds and forms, and no bondage to passionate or emotional consciousness. This principle must be taught carefully. Therefore, when you hear teaching about the non-sentient, do not think that this refers to fences and walls. And I think we can include fences and walls, but if we think that that's just what this is about, in this case, Keizan is emphasizing this subtle consciousness, this nature of mind. That can meet fences and walls directly. It is simply that when you're not attached to emotion and thought and your perceptions are not scattered, the subtle consciousness is clear and unobscured, clearly and distinctly bright. Even though you attempt to grasp this realm, it's not possible. Since it's not bound by form, it does not exist. Even though you attempt to get rid of it, you cannot leave it. So, it's not something that you can grasp. It's not something you can get away from. Since it has accompanied you since time immemorial, it is not non-existent. So, this beautiful middle way teaching that this consciousness, since it's not bound by form, it does not exist. But since it's been with you from beginning this time, it's not non-existent. It doesn't fall into inherent existence or inherent non-existence. Still, it is not the working of consciousness, knowing, or thought. Dualistic consciousness, knowing, or thought, much less something connected to the four elements or five aggregates. It's not connected to earth, wind, fire, and water. It's not connected to form, feeling, perception, formations, or consciousness. That's the kind of subtle mind that is the non-sentient, which is constantly teaching the Dharma. And even in Dogen's universal instructions for Zazen, he does bring up similar teachings. Right? He's, in our Zazen instruction, he says, in the Fukan Zazengi, cease all the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thought and views. I don't know how we, when we hear Dogen's instructions like that, how do we apply that, if we do, to our Zazen practice? We might put that in that category of, that sounds way beyond me, I would never be able to actually cease all the movements of the conscious mind, stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and views. Or in the Shobo Genzo Zazengi, Dogen says, instead of giving the instruction of what to do, the kind of like instructional teaching to stop all these conscious movements, he just describes Zazen. He says, Zazen is not mind, thought, or consciousness. Zazen is not a practice and realization of mind, thought, or consciousness. But according to Keizan's teaching here, we could say Zazen is this subtle consciousness, this subtle nature of mind that is not running off after sounds and forms, and not bound to a usual emotional consciousness. Hung Jur, who wrote the poems Cultivating the Empty Field, one of the favorite Cao Dong ancestors of Dogen and Keizan, said, there is a knowing apart from passionate thought and discrimination. There is a body that is not the four elements and five aggregates. That's what he said. That is, it is the subtle consciousness. Always teaching keenly or fully means that its manifestation at all times is teaching. So this subtle consciousness called the non-sentient is constantly teaching the Dharma, as we've heard. The manifestations of this subtle consciousness are at all times teaching. It, this subtle consciousness, makes one raise one's eyebrows and blink. It makes one walk, stand, sit, and lie down, be confused, get into trouble, die here and be born there, eat when hungry and sleep when tired. All these, without exception, are the teaching of the non-sentient. So, there's the non-sentient that just rests as present open awareness. And then the way it teaches, the non-sentient constantly teaches the Dharma through making the eyebrows raise and blink, making us sit, stand, walk, lie down. This is its teaching. The non-sentient's teaching is making us get into trouble and be confused. So it's not just like all enlightened. I mean, it is all enlightened teaching, but it takes the form of getting us into trouble. And then we, because we don't recognize that our getting into trouble is the teaching of the non-sentient, we think we're really in trouble. And then we're really in trouble. It makes us actually die here and be born there. It makes us eat when hungry and sleep when tired, which, you know, comes from this Lin Ji's famous statement. I don't remember exactly how it goes, but something like the profound activity of the Buddhas and ancestors is simply sleeping when tired and eating when hungry. Wise people laugh at me. Fools laugh at me, but the wise ones understand. So what is it that causes us to bow and rise when the bell rings? It's the teaching of the non-sentient. Speech, work, movement, and cessation of movement are also teaching of the non-sentient. It's not just a verbal or non-verbal teaching. It is that one who appears magnificently. Keizan, this is one of those phrases that they call an aspect of Keizan Zen, as opposed to Dogen Zen. Keizan uses these phrases like the Lord of the House, and you know, that old fellow, and that one, to talk about the non-sentient mind. And Dogen doesn't use those kind of phrases because I think he maybe sees the danger in making it into something like the undying person in the hermitage is like, we just can't help but grasp it as this essence, some kind of like truly existent subtle essence. So Dogen talks more about just going beyond everything we think could be what's happening. But Keizan doesn't mind saying it is in this case, you know, in English, that one with capital T and O, that one, it is that one who appears magnificently, is very bright and never dark, since it is revealed in everything, including the croaking of bullfrogs and the sounds of earthworms. Have you heard those sounds of earthworms? It constantly teaches fully without cessation. If you can see it fully, then someday, like our eminent ancestor Dongshan, you will be able to be an example for others. Then Keizan's concluding verse, how can I express this principle concisely? The verse is, extremely fine, subtle consciousness is not emotional attachment. It constantly makes that one teach keenly, fully, deeply. Extremely fine, subtle consciousness, the non-sentient, is not emotional attachment. Constantly makes that one teach the Dharma incessantly, completely. Thus concludes the story of ancestor Dongshan. Later in his life felt like the essential teaching that he would pass on to his disciple and would then get passed along through many generations up to us is the teaching of the jewel mirror samadhi. So fine, it fits into spacelessness. So great, it's utterly beyond location. Is the samadhi, is the one-pointed absorption in the mind of precious mirror awareness, the same as the non-sentient beings, constantly teaching Dharma? That one, always clear and bright, never dark. Able to reflect walls and tiles and pebbles just as they are. It doesn't go or come. Rise or stand. Truly, in the end, nothing can really be said about it except Baba Wawa. Just baby babble. This teaching of suchness, radiantly aware suchness, has been intimately communicated by all these ancestors. And since you all already have it, please take care of it. Any final comments? Yes. Edie.
Is that why faith and doubt arise together?
Is what why?
Yes, that's what's on my mind when you talk about something you can't talk about.
Yeah, faith and doubt arising together. The Rinzai Zen teaching of Hakuin Zenji, he says there's three bases, three of Zen practice, three legs of a tripod that hold up the soup pot of Buddhahood. And these three legs, if you take one away, the pot will topple over and spill. And the three are faith, doubt, and great determination. So as I recall, it's like first you kind of like start with great faith, great trust in the teaching of the non-sentient, in Buddha nature. We hear that Buddha nature pervades all of us, and that we don't have to create it or improve it or do anything about it. We just have to reveal what's already here. We hear such a teaching, and we develop faith and trust in this, and then kind of along with that, maybe as our faith develops, along with that, our doubt develops too, because our doubt is that, well, if this is so, then like, why am I like caught up in all this stuff all the time and like have all these problems and suffering seems so all pervading? How could this be if this pure, free Buddha nature is really who we are? And then that creates this kind of tension. The faith and the doubt create this kind of tension. And in Rinzai Zen, more than Soto Zen, they really love to like develop this tension more and more. And then the great determination is like staying with this tension and letting it build up. I mean, that technique is koan practice, which kind of has these two sides. Letting this great ball of doubt, like a molten hot iron ball that we swallow, fills our stomach, as they say in that lineage. And the great determination is just like, don't spit it out too quickly. Let it just cook in there. This faith and doubt working together until everything is resolved in a moment of the non-sentient teaching the Dharma, and a non-sentient being hearing the Dharma. How do we how do we say it in Dogen's vow? We vow with all beings from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, may no doubt arise in us, nor will we lack it in faith. So the doubt is kind of like, the doubt almost kind of creates the problem around faith. But they often do come up together. And then, what's the mind of true faith? At the end, Dogen says it's repenting our lack of faith, and practice is the true mind of faith, the true body of faith. That's an interesting twist too. What's the true mind of faith? Repenting our lack of faith. Thank you for being here today, doing this strange practice. You know, for this time, we've all put everything else aside to do this, even if our minds are still like engaged in all that other stuff. Where like our bodies are here, and it's up to us. If we don't do this practice, who will? Thank you. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.